Welcome back to the On Call Nightmares podcast. My name is Jay Gordon, and every week I come here to bring you interviews with technologists who have been on call. So I guess that it's been kind of a rough week for Facebook and Instagram. I saw that they had some pretty big outages yesterday. I don't know why, but I'm going to go and start looking for a postmortem pretty soon because it's interesting to see about how and when these things occur. I've read something just anecdotally that it had to do with a large query against a database, and that database query couldn't be killed. I don't know if that's the truth, but we'll see what happens when postmortem information comes out. But that is neither here nor there. Once again, we have another interview this week. It's with Andrew Clay Schaefer of Pivotal, and I've talked with Andrew off and on Twitter very often, but we talk back and forth, and in the last, year or so, he and I have chatted a little bit more off and on, and I had really gotten an idea of what his mentality around this was just by watching some of his talks on YouTube. So I really want you to get from Andrew the idea of sometimes it's worth it to be a conscientious developer if you're not specifically on call for a project. And I really, really appreciated that kind of thought. So check out this interview. And if you would like to be interviewed for the podcast, I'm going to make it really easy for you. Just send me an email, oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Or reach out to me on Twitter. It's either at OnCallNightmare or at JDestro, and you'll get an opportunity to reach out to me and see if we can make things align so you can be a part of this podcast. So rather than for me to continue to drone on and bore you with this advertisement to beg you to come on, I will get into our interview with Andrew. Always thank you for listening. Let's get to it. Welcome back to another episode of the On Call Nightmares podcast. My name is Jay, and today I'm going to bring to you someone that I really been looking forward to talking to for a little while, because when you spend time in this tech world, whether it's ops or DevOps or whatever, you hear voices that stand out, and I really think Andrew's voice stands out as one that really gives great information. So Andrew Clay Schaefer is the Senior Director of Technology at Pivotal. He's been at some really great places, and I'll let him tell you that, but welcome to the podcast.
I've been in a few places, some greater than others.
And I like to keep it very, very simple and direct. You've been some places. So why don't you tell us about some of those places you've been in the past?
So in the kind of on-call theme, the second startup I worked for was a web service that had this kind of e-commerce solution. And I came to this kind of on-call world from the other side. I was never really tasked with on-call. I sort of picked up that mantle as a conscientious developer, right? And one of the things I would say, looking at the theme, like we kind of live in this golden age for some of this where you have the SRE book, you have the DevOps Days has been a conference now for 10 years. You have the Velocity Conference and all these little communities of practice. But back then, this is, over 10 years ago, you didn't really have that kind of information. And there's sort of this transition from software being something that got shipped on CDs to the internet being the dominant mode that everyone kind of connects and consumes software. So as you move to that world, that elevates the need for those servers to stay up and running. And I just got sick of disappointing our customers as a conscientious developer. So I would say that watching this all evolve, that there's almost no distinction between an SRE and a conscientious developer. Like if you care about what you're actually doing beyond just the minimum viable, whatever story thing you were given to check off for your sprint for the week, then you're going to fix these problems for,
Yeah, no problem. You're on call. It's okay.
That was actually my mother.
I had something similar happen recently with
Paul Reed, where like he was in the middle of one of these podcasts and the call came up and I said, oh, you must be on call too. But they make for great moments of organic conversation in this podcast. So we're keeping that in.
So this responsibility of being on call for me, like no one ever said like you have to be on call. I mean, I hear a lot of horror stories from some of my best friends that have been through that path that kind of came up from the ops path where they have things that they're, I mean, essentially it borders on inhumane, like the way that this gets managed in a lot of organizations from the perspective of what's expected, from the perspective of the actual staffing, all these things that you kind of hear, like just, you know, make people have, for lack of a better word, like just such a poor dehumanizing experience as a downstream kind of like recipient of a bunch of decisions that they don't have any control over. Right. So I never fully had that in the sense that I almost always had the ability to, at least when I was taking these kind of responsibilities, to impact the thing that was changing. Right. Like I, as a developer, could see what was getting deployed. I understood what was getting deployed. I understood why I was getting deployed. And I had some understanding of what it would interact with and some of those things that could cause problems with. At a certain scale or at a certain level of distance from that process, I think you lose that ability. And especially when you're inheriting these systems that have been in place for a long time and maybe even no one in the building kind of understands them, you end up with a very different scenario than you see in what I'll call kind of the high-performing, like cloud-native SRE space that we all aspire to be part of right now.
And I think for the most part, the availability of instant infrastructure has been one of the biggest kind of changes, is that when you need more, you can get more pretty quickly. And that has made a huge change in, well, you know, this thing is screwed up, so let's make a decision on whether or not we shoot it in the head and continue with you know, just rebuilding a process and moving on, or and I think that that's been one of the biggest things I've seen that has really taken that SRE and helped them grow just beyond the conscientious developer.
Right. So there's an aspect of the problems that used to be pervasive that kind of just go away in a world where you can provision things with cloud resources. Right. So this is sort of the pets not cattle mindset. In the olden days, you know, back in the day when you actually had physical hardware in a data center, which people still do, obviously. Then when that hardware is not working, like your service is not working. Right. And so like it starts at the bottom level and then comes up from there. But in the world we live in now, there's a whole class of those problems that could go away pretty quickly if you're even somewhat mindful, and especially if you have the resources, right? Because this is not necessarily free. So you used to have to buy all the gear from Sun or whatever, and then you know you over provision and you try to build this kind of redundancy at the hardware level. Now you can kind of take for granted that you could essentially redeploy all of your infrastructure in minutes. You know, maybe there's some up lower bound for how fast you can do it, but it's on the order of hours at most, not days. Like you don't have to get someone to ship you actual gear usually to fix infrastructure problems. So there's a whole bunch of things that just go away from that.
And I think that some of your earlier work, just from what I know around, you know, either Puppet or you know, OpenStack and stuff like that, you know, places where people were able to start growing beyond just that, we've got 10 servers. Let's just worry about those 10 servers. Obviously, I really believe that codifying information and making it simpler to deploy has been part of that revolution where no longer do we see people scared of telling developers, can you look at this particular problem? It's not just on top of the ops team or who we call DevOps or SRE.
I'll tell a little bit more of my story and I'll come back to this. So the flow of my career from this startup that I just described, you know, then goes through a period of participating in Puppet and doing a lot of stuff there and not just, you know, around that tool, but also around kind of like these maturing of processes and particularly around trying to apply sort of the agile mindset and agile engineering practices to operations. And, mm-hmm. and later, like I did some OpenStack stuff and I spent some time at Rackspace and whatever. And now I've been working more on Cloud Foundry and, you know, every day I think everyone's getting more and more focused on Kubernetes and serverless and like these newer abstractions. But in that beginning phase, what I was really enamored with and what I kind of started articulating, which became sort of this DevOps conversation, but originally I called agile infrastructure, mm-hmm. was this belief that if you are going to practice agile as a software developer, then those agile engineering techniques all start with being able to build your code from source, right? So everything goes back to being able to rapidly build from source. You can't do any sort of unit testing. You can't do any sort of, you know, continuous integration until you solve this build from source problem. Mm-hmm. And then you extend that to infrastructure. So there's a period of time where, and some people still live in this period, where a lot of people's problems with their deployments to production had to do with nuanced differences between their development testing and production environments.
Yes.
And so
yes.
Finding ways to reduce the variation and express that in code and taking that continuous integration build from source mentality down one level to the infrastructure was like my big focus for a while. And that's sort of where, you know, a lot of this stuff, I don't know. I thought it was fascinating and interesting. Now we get to, you know, an even higher level of this where we have, because we used to do this kind of policy based mutate the state across the fleet of servers, enforce policy mm-hmm. with tools like Puppet. But now you can do things where you're basically building these artifacts as a function of your build that are machine images, right? Like that's what the container deployment strategies are all about, is that your build is actually producing this verified, you know, guaranteed to work image. It doesn't fix all your SQL queries or like these other problems, but it will fix like this variation in like underlying library dependencies and this kind of stuff that people used to really struggle with.
And I think Docker in itself really, really helped people start getting an idea of like, all right, what does a unified infrastructure kind of look like to do things, whether it's, you know, here on my computer or on a cloud machine? Let's make sure that we don't have much variation in the two.
And so it's interesting, like Docker helped people see this, but mm-hmm. look at the kind of historical evolution of these things.
Yeah.
That pattern was already in practice with VMs in some context, right? So the way, when you go look at the early microservice talks from Adrian at Netflix at the time, mm-hmm. they're talking about how they were baking the AMIs and then doing these deployments. It was essentially the same style of deployment, this immutable infrastructure idea. It was just codified at the level of the machine images of VMs instead of the images in the container side.
Sure. So the old idea of like gold master certified, ready to go, put it inside of your auto scaling and hope for the best for this particular release.
Not even a gold master though, like the actual application level. So they would bake the app into the images.
Oh, okay. So I gotcha.
Yeah. So it's everything
from deployment on is done through one disk image.
Exactly the same pattern that you see with Docker, except at the VM level.
Very cool.
Just the tooling and the speed are different, right? So like when you get to the, because mm-hmm. container is basically the speed of starting a process, where, you know, VM has a little different overhead and arc to start it up or whatever. But that same kind of mentality, the same kind of pattern. There's also a fascinating, like all this stuff dovetails together, right? So there's this social technical thing, and there's definitely, at least from my perspective, a huge benefit to humanizing the people that have these responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but every organization that I've ever talked to has a gold mine of these externalized human costs that are in their both their on-call and their customer support organization. Mm-hmm. So it's like you, if you are really good at your job of being on call, especially if you are willing and kind of able to bear the brunt of these bad decisions that are made upstream, then you, in some cases, basically enable this kind of weird, like, codependent behavior where no one has to pay the price, right? Like, the mm-hmm. app doesn't pay the price, the customers don't pay the price. So it can be like a somewhat unhealthy relationship if you're really, really good at being on call, because you were so good at responding to these incidents, you're so good at, like, keeping that reliability with your essentially human blood, human toil, mm-hmm. that all of the things that you could fix with, we both spent some time at Rackspace, right? And so if you look at the arc of this cloud narrative and the SRE narrative, like, what Rackspace actually got very, very good at, and some of the best, what I'll call fire jumpers I've ever met, mm-hmm. were these Rackspace kind of support engineers.
Yeah, I when I was with Datapipe pre-acquisition, I was one of those types of people. And so I get what you're saying. We were first, there was no tiered support. It was you talk to Windows or you talk to Unix. Those were the people you called, and you didn't get on a tree. You were just put on the phone with a person. And I learned more in my career from that experience, even though it was bearing the brunt of toil. Without a doubt, I spent so much time on a phone call being both yelled at, but then thanked for doing things within the same 5 minutes of, holy, holy shit, this doesn't work, I'm losing millions of dollars a minute, to, oh, you fixed Apache that I messed up, explain to me why and what. And so these kind of things where they were super high velocity because you had some random operator on the other side making bad, bad changes. You didn't know what was going on. And at least now we're seeing less and less of that, because even people who are those, like, rando, you know, operators, they're actually starting to use these practices too.
Well, they're more available to us, right? They're more, yes, available to everyone. So it's not everyone has to, like, make it up as they go. Like, you can go to these communities, you can go to these resources, and you can get ideas. But Rackspace represents a very interesting point in time in the industry, because they essentially codified this behavior in a way. Like, they literally had a wall that, and I think they probably still do, although, you know, they're in a very different part of their evolution as a company than they were then. But they had this wall of fanatical support, and they would literally take pictures of people in straitjackets.
Yes.
And you won the right to be on the wall in a straitjacket for doing, like, these crazy things, right? Like,
yeah,
doing heroic kind of superhuman efforts to restore things. And
I remember, like, Major Hayden posting photos of, like, him in, like, a straitjacket back when, you know, years and years ago when I read his blog and downloaded my SQL tuner.perl. So yeah, I get it. I remember those days.
But then the thing to see and reflect on is, at the same time that this is happening, those problems with reliability are mm-hmm. being fixed in other organizations with software.
Yes.
And so this is the thing that I like about the SRE book explicitly framing the core principle of eliminating toil.
Right. I think once I started seeing people, especially with networks, start getting made, like, software-defined networks, you even saw more problems being reduced, because you started seeing people using software engineering ideas to fix problems, as opposed to having to buy additional hardware and then work with the networking vendor to make everything work.
Make everything work three times because, you know, redundancy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit. I know we've been kind of going off, and I want to make sure that I bring up one thing. So I only bring up the rules because it's part of my stupid, like, little want for the show, even though it's not stupid, it's my want. But I'm just going to make sure that throughout the conversation, we make sure that you don't incriminate yourself, even if something nasty happens and you wanted to talk about it. Please don't. Don't incriminate anyone else, because we always believe in being blameless in our retrospectives. And even in this podcast, I look at it as a blameless retrospective, even though I've had some people blame themselves. And just help us learn. And so far, I think you've really helped us learn by giving us some look back on the things that you did.
One thing I really want to ask you is, since you never really had to be part of a rotation, do you remember a moment where you had to actually just say to somebody, like, look, I understand what's going on here. Can I just be part of the conversation?
Yes and no, without incriminating myself. There's lots of places and lots of times where, like, I made myself involved, but I never really – when I was at my kind of responsibility and, like, really cared about running services, I was always welcomed. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's partly the circumstance. Maybe that's partly my personality. But I didn't have to be, like, the guy that kind of, like, takes over because reasons. But it was, like, everyone was very welcoming and like, wanted my help. And usually – you know, there's like some interesting stories. Like I remember doing things on live systems that, like, you probably should never do to fix problems that were, like, this is just like a silly little example of we didn't necessarily have an incident, but we had this daily response from a particular customer who had a lot of people using our system that it was slow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's the worst thing you can hear.
Yes.
It gives you, like, no information about anything. It's like slow. Okay. So
my website is slow is a thing I used to hear a lot in the days of, like, single server, you know, calls when someone with one machine with everything on would just be like, my website's slow.
So at this phase, I was basically a developer-esque person and I had these operational concerns and we hear it was slow every day. And This is a time, you know, this is what we're talking about over 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, we didn't have observability. Like, we didn't have good monitoring. We didn't really know what was going on these systems, right? So we did the matrix view of tail minus F on a bunch of logs and, like, try to figure out what was going on. And there was this one day everything ground to a halt and they're like, it's slow. And everyone's, you know, it's the middle of the day. And what I figured out on these live systems was someone had introduced this one block in the middle of this request for this workflow that was synchronized and it was taking a lock. And so basically it was only a problem when you had a lot of people trying to do the same thing. So there was, like, these certain times of day when you could see this problem, but most of the time it wasn't a problem unless this, like, one subset of customers all tried to do this one thing at the same time.
So, like, a thundering herd on one thing.
Which they did almost every single day. It's kind of like the, you know, the morning or, like, right after lunch or whatever when they all kind of, like, did this same thing. And we get all these, oh, it's slow, whatever. And so, you know, the fix is basically easy. Like, once you actually see what's wrong, it's like, oh, like, you're locking all of these things across all these people who are logged in. And at this point in time, you're not talking about millions of users. Like, this wasn't BuzzFeed or anything crazy, but it's like thousands of people. And so then once you take and figure out, okay, like, how can we keep this thing from getting locked? Like, it's fast again. Right. And it's just like understanding and getting that. So this was from a troubleshooting perspective, it was interesting because, like, is this ephemeral problem that you could only see in this one scenario, or it would only be as obvious as it was in this one scenario? I don't know if I'm, like, the best kind of person to take advice for troubleshooting live systems, but that was like a fun day, and, like, I fixed the problem, and, you know, whatever.
So. those are always cool when you're not heavily involved, but you know enough to be dangerous. I think,
like, compared to some of the stories I would hear from those fire jumpers at what the company we were just talking about, like, I was just blown away by, one, the variety of things. Cause like, I think there's also a little bit of a difference in the things that you learn when you, like, own everything and the types of decisions you can make. Like, you basically get the opportunity to not have problems by choosing not to have them. Right. Like, you don't have to solve a problem if you don't have it. And if you design things in a certain way, like, you don't have those problems. But when you're in a place like Rackspace was, and you have hundreds of customers, all of which have different hardware configurations, all of which have different application configurations, then the type of exposure that you get jumping into those calls where you're just like, I mean, I just heard like crazy stories where there's like storage failing, mm-hmm. and it's like you're running DD on these live systems. Yep. I get like the thing to like somehow like be alive on the other side of it. Is
or like, 12 hour FISCs that you have to be the person that calls the person back and said, look, the disk is still FISCing. We promise you we're going to get it back up. I mean, these are, I think that the hardest part that we don't really kind of have conversations about, because we've separated so much the customer facing group from the people who are kind of fixing the problems, that back, I guess, when I was doing it in one of them type of fire jumpers, if you will, and I hate doing back in the day stuff, but seriously, back in the day was a combination of being able to answer the problem and also speak to a person on the phone and realistically keep them in a position where they're not going to be freaking out. And that was, I mean, that was traumatic in times, because I definitely remember coming home from work and talking to my wife and saying like, how can I do this for 20 more years?
So this is an interesting little thread to pull on. The aspect of the technical troubleshooting and kind of being the responsible one is one thing, but there's another side of this, and this has to do with humans in basically like all these different roles, where you want to maintain the confidence in like the capabilities of the organization. So you talking about when you're talking with a customer who's running a thing, but you're also in a lot of organizations talking about the rest of the organization itself, right? And so when something goes wrong, you want to be able to take responsibility for it, understanding, you know, there's no root cause, whatever, like that's sort of the in vogue thing people say right now, which is, it's funny.
Cascading series of events, no root cause.
I mean, this again, another side, but, yeah. But like, I think it's actually, it's not helpful right now when people are like language policing for saying there's no root cause, because one, it's a language that's used. So having that as language, well, maybe there's some benefit to refactoring the language, but to me, the important thing for that is like, how do you actually maintain that confidence and do it in a way that changes behaviors and learning, right? So if you've seen any of my talks in the last, you know, 5 years, one of the major themes that I try to bring out in all this is the capacity for individuals and organizations to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And by definition, you know, the definition that I use, you didn't learn anything until you change your behavior. So you know,
that makes so much sense. And I really do. I have to remember that. Thank you.
If you didn't change your behavior, then you got information, but you didn't really learn. Right. And this is actually quite easy to prove when you start talking about certain types of activities, playing a sport. Mm-hmm. Playing chess, playing a musical instrument, right? So you can either beat a better player or you can't. When you learn, you can beat better players. When you learn to play music, you can play harder songs, you know, more intricate, express more complex musical ideas. And that's pretty easy to measure. When you start to get into the political oatmeal that most of this work is embedded in, mm-hmm. and you know, we try to pride ourselves on being metrics driven and data driven, but for the most part, like, humans are just big bags of feelings.
Yes.
And that drives our behaviors much more than anything else. And it's much harder to say from an organizational perspective that like we learned a thing. Like a lot of times, just, I mean, this is the whole thing. Like, organizational learning is the only sustained advantage. And if you can change your behavior given new information, then your organization learns. And if you can't, then you don't, right? And so everyone has all this information available to them about how to do on-call, about how to do cloud-native architectures, about how to do all this stuff. And on one hand, it's somewhat overwhelming because there's almost more information than you can process. On the other hand, I see lots of places, lots of people who have that information available to them, and are essentially willfully disregarding it to say, oh, well, that's not how we do things here, right? And like keeping the old way, regardless of the actual performance or the, you know, impact on their customers, their or themselves, you know, frankly. So.
Sure. Like I just to kind of create a situation, like I remember going to a place that had the deploy script, if you will, and you tell people, look, the deploy script isn't going to, you know, work long term. Like you have to go in and manually added additional servers into the deploy script of where the deploy is supposed to go to. And you know there are better ways of doing this. Why continue it? And sometimes people will just say, because we know it works. But knowing it works is you know, not necessarily – like you know if you throw water on fire, it's going to put the fire out. But if it's a grease fire, it's not. And that's like kind of the way I look at it, is that we know that there are some absolutes, but sometimes there aren't.
So,
and that's what I've been learning from.
Not to totally play devil's advocate, but like I don't actually have a problem with the deploy script in a sense, right? So it's like, yeah, the deploy script, like whatever you're talking about, whether it's a tool like Puppet or Chef or Kubernetes or Docker for that matter, at the bottom of that thing, there's a bunch of stuff that looks suspiciously like janky bash. And it's like essentially, like all we're doing is kind of like cobbling together ways to hide our deploy scripts in like a little bit more abstracted and ordered way. So if someone has a deploy script that's working for them, like my first thing to do or my first suggestion to them is not to admonish them for having a deploy script, but let's get it into some sort of CI system, or let's get it into version control. If it's not version control, you know, then and this is like from the olden days when everyone had like do it 5.sh or whatever, like the fifth step of the deployment was like in your home directory, right? So
yeah.
Like let's get it to where we have a little bit more shared understanding. We could version control it and then start hooking up a little bit of testing and monitoring. To me, you want to incrementally make that improvement more than you want to say like, oh, you know, you what you're doing isn't working. When it like clearly does work, like it does work to some level. So
gotcha. So I want to start bringing us home and rolling us toward the end, because there's some people who are probably in their car getting ready to turn off onto the exit, or maybe you're on your subway and you're getting close to your.
We got to time it for that East Coast commute.
Or I was going to say, or maybe the baby's going to start crying soon because you know that they went down for a nap. And so I wanted to ask you, because here's a question I haven't been able to ask a lot of people, because to be honest with you, I haven't gotten many parents. I know you're a parent. Tell me a little bit about being a parent and how you have had work impact you. Have you ever had moments where you kind of had to use parenting skills to make an incident seem a little bit less hectic to you?
So, oh man, there's so many ways to go with this. So there's being a parent, and then there's almost like a whole nother episode that we should do, because my wife, like being a parent reminds me of my whole like family unit, and my wife is a medical doctor.
Gotcha.
And so she carries an actual pager. Mm. Right. And she has on-call responsibilities for the last 10 years, more than me, and still does, right? And
gotcha.
And it's not like, oh, there's like the server and like there's some people that can't get their thing or whatever. It's like, here's a photo at 2 a.m. with like a dude's face gashed open and my wife like basically being upset that particular gash in that particular place means it's going to take a long time because I have to sew his tear ducts back together, right?
Yes.
Like this is a totally different kind of cost and impact of like that. And she has, just like many of our friends and colleagues, definitely experienced burnout and resentment and like all these other things. And it's just it's like totally different thing. So we'll maybe save that. Like that would be fascinating. Sure. To think about, like,
or if you and Jess ever get that, Jesse get that podcast going or something, that's a really good one also.
We're working on that too. So we'll maybe bring that up as like, maybe we'll have my better half on a show at some point, but
yeah, I've been lucky. What's his name? Baron, Schwartz, he did an interview with me recently, and the one thing that he brought up was, you know, he had prior on-call experience as an EMT. And so I thought that was really interesting. So to see that you actually have insight into a physician's life on-call, I think gives you a little bit more perspective. And I think maybe you mentioning yourself as not necessarily being an on-call resource, but more of a conscientious developer is a really good term. And I think it's almost like pre-SRE, if you will, for some people. And so I actually want to ask this as a question. How do you think people can be more conscientious developers in their organization?
Well, I was going to talk about my kids real quick. Cause I like the
okay. kids. Sounds like you were blowing that one off, but
that's no, I didn't mean to blow it off. I just got,
it's okay.
Sorry about my wife. Yeah. So there's definitely things that you learn about yourself as a human being. Some of them are fun lessons and some of them are hard lessons when you have kids, right? So like kids, they don't do what they're told all the time. They have their own little minds, you know, especially mine can be somewhat mischievous and they're all boys. And like you learn some things about how to communicate to get people to, well, I mean, good and bad, right? Like, I don't know where you're at in this story. I learned some of these things, you know, being young and having siblings and
like I had siblings. I've got a dog, but no kids. And so I learn a lot from parents that are, you know, around my age group, because I think that they give me some of that info that I just can't learn. You know, I'm not going to be a parent. It's not what in the cards for me. So yeah. Hearing how professionally being a parent also changes how you do things is interesting to me.
I mean, in some ways it's just like this self-imposed, like overwhelming hobby that you can like never stop doing. Right. Like unless, I mean, I guess other people maybe are worse parents than me, but like you can't really stop. Right. And they need, in some ways, like you're always on call for your kids, like until you die in a different sense of it. Right.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the other thing, because we wanted to get people.
Sure. So yeah. But I thank you for coming back to the kids. So yeah, like I was saying, you know, you said you're maybe being a parent has made you more conscientious. I don't know. You might have already been that person, but how do you?
I think I was pretty conscientious. I think I have a lot of empathy for other humans, and I particularly as a developer feel bad if people aren't getting kind of value from what I've created, and. Mm-hmm. They're not getting value if the site's down, right? So I, you know, for whatever reason or character flaws, I got into this mode where, and now we have the SRE book and we have these discussions in the open, but there's two things I think I want to make a point here. So there's the fact that the best thing you could do to improve your operational capabilities and on-call is improve your development capabilities. Like build this kind of reliability into the software, build it in from the first principles at the application level, right? So, mm-hmm. So it's a understanding, and that comes from, in many cases, in fact, I would say in all kind of quote unquote cloud native cases, from putting on call responsibilities onto the developers. Like there's no organization.
Definitely been more common nowadays too.
It's literally like there's no cloud native organization that doesn't do that to some degree. And then people get confused about the way Google does SRE and think, oh, well, the SREs have all this operational burden. In some sense, they do have operational burden, but the goal of SRE, at least from my kind of interpretation, having never worked at Google, but having many friends that work there, is not so much that you are trying to take the burden off of the software engineers so that you can, you know, do this thing for them, but that through the process, the reliability assessments and the rest of the thing that's kind of codified in that book is that you're trying to drive the operational burden down to zero. So then it's trivial to take call for service that you've built to be highly reliable. You're not on fire all the time because you preemptively and with forethought, use the software engineering software skills to make that go away. So putting developers on call changes their behavior. And then the second thing that I want to make a main point on here is that operations and those operational people, and especially when you get into this SRE world, they are developers, they are engineers. And so it kind of like hurts my heart a little bit when you hear people who are, you know, self-identifying as sysadmin say, oh, I don't want to code. I don't want to do that. Cause that's what developers do. Right. Like you look at the code that you wrote in Bash and like, for some reason, like some people convince themselves that wasn't programming and that's silly. Like take everything you do and put it through this lens, like learn, don't like self limit yourself to say, oh, I can't do that. Cause that's not my self-identified role. Like think about this from an engineering perspective and grow that software development muscle and apply it to operations and apply it to your sysadmin work. And that's really where you see this kind of explosion of ideas around, you know, the DevOps tools and you know, to where we are today.
Awesome. So Andrew, thank you so much for some time today. I really, really appreciate it. We're going to kind of bring it and wrap it all up, bring it all home. And I want to make sure people know how to get in touch with you if they would like to. I believe you're on Twitter as Little Idea, correct?
Little Idea, all one words, all lowercase, although it's not case sensitive. And then I'm also Andrew Clay Schaefer on LinkedIn, and I have open DMs, and I don't always respond immediately, but I try to be somewhat personable.
Well, thanks a lot. You know, you gave me some different perspective on things, and another way to think about this big old weird thing that is on call. So thanks again. We will be right back to wrap up the podcast. Once again, just thanks so much, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this. I hope that, you know, this is valuable to people. I know that some of the other stuff that you're doing has definitely been interesting conversation starter and valuable people. So thanks for putting in the work.
Cool. So we'll see you on Twitter and everywhere else. And everybody else, like I said, we'll be right back to finish up the podcast. So stay tuned.
Cheers.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you so much, Andrew. That was a really great conversation. You can find Andrew on Twitter at Little Idea. I really recommend you follow him just because he's got so many great ideas about how to work better. And so that's really what this podcast is all about, is helping people work better. If you're actually on call, I really want to talk to you the most. So if you're part of an on-call rotation, please get in touch with me. I'd like to have you on the podcast. I need to get some more recorded because I got a lot of traveling to do. And I would like to have a few kind of ready to go, so let's talk to you. Reach out to me at jdestro, at oncallnightmare, I'm both on Twitter, or oncallnightmares@gmail.com. We'll catch you next time. I'm going to be out of town next week, but hopefully I will have an episode for you with another person who has had a nightmare being on call. We'll catch you next time.